Hey there, Paula Poundstone here. When you're done listening to this podcast, check out my new show, Live from the Poundstone Institute. I mean, you could try listening to this show and my show at the same time, but that might drive you insane. Find Live from the Poundstone Institute on Apple Podcasts or the NPR One app.
You would expect a certain intensity from a film called Atomic Blonde. It's based on a graphic novel called The Coldest City. It stars Charlize Theron as a merciless, relentless, and impossibly well-dressed British spy named Lorraine. Just as the Berlin Wall is about to come down, Lorraine is dispatched to recover something dangerous before it falls into the hands of the KGB. Directed by David Leitch, a longtime stuntman who co-directed John Wick, Atomic Blonde also stars James McAvoy, John Goodman, Toby Jones, and Sophia Boutella. There's a lot of kicking, a lot of shooting, and in general, a lot of things that look like they would really, really hurt, all set to an 80s beat. I'm Linda Holmes. We're cranking New Order as loud as it will go on this episode of Pop Culture Happy Hour.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Helix, where one test can provide a lifetime of personal insights, from nutrition and fitness to family planning and entertainment. At Helix.com, discover a marketplace of DNA-powered products and find out what your DNA can tell you. Helix, crack your code.
Before we get started, let's go around the table. I am at NPR West and back in D.C.
I am Stephen Thompson with NPR Music.
I'm Glenn Weldon. I write for the NPR website.
And in our fourth chair, one of our favorite people, our friend Chris Klimek. Hi, Chris.
Hi.
It's always good to have you around, especially when we are dealing with punching.
Yes, the Charlize Theron fighting in stairwells correspondent gig.
Exactly.
That I've been lobbying for finally came open.
I know. It's true. I want to go to Glenn first. What did you think of this movie? How did it strike you?
Well, I have a long history with this movie, actually. I tried to see it at South by Southwest, but I got cut off the line right before me. I was waiting in line 45 minutes to try to see it. People who came out of it were raving about it. I was, I think, a bit misled going into this film, both by the ad campaign and by some of the reviews that I kind of glanced at. I was expecting a 90-minute long trailer. I was expecting everything to be kind of amped up, the costumes, the lighting, the music, kind of camped up, too. Kind of an I Love the 80s, very stylized, you know, movies like Liquid Sky and The Hunger, you know, lots of neon and smoke machines and mohawks. And it starts out that way. We start out, she steps out of a car, we get a close-up on the heel that she's wearing.
Yep.
She walks, she's got this look that's very Berlin, not the place, but the band.
Right.
And
true.
Blue Monday by New Order is playing, and I'm like, I know what this is. I don't know what this is, because a lot of what folks were saying about it were all style, no substance, glitzy, surfacey, stylized, slick. There is a beating heart to this movie that is pulpy and bloody and visceral, and that surprised me, and it gave it a little bit of extra depth. And she's basically doing everything Jason Bourne does, mm-hmm. backwards and in heels, and I am here for it.
Nice. Before we move on, when you say a beating heart, what do you mean by that, aside from the kind of the literal bloody meaning of a beating heart?
I mean mostly that latter thing, because there's plenty of blood. This is R. This is not Jason Bourne.
Yeah.
I think most of the Jason Bourne films are PG-13, right, Chris?
Yeah, they all are.
Yeah. So this has a bit more weight to it, even though it looks fantastic and sounds wonderful. There is a stairway brawl, which we will talk about, which I would put up there with some of the best fight scenes I have ever seen.
Fight. Yeah.
So that's what I mean. There's a weight to this that you might not expect if you're just going by what you're reading about or listening to.
Okay. Stephen, what did you think?
I agree with a lot of what Glenn said. I do think, however, that stairwell scene, a fantastic fight scene, does kind of form a little bit of a fulcrum in this movie, where it starts to tilt from this kind of fun, almost playful quality. Like there are like jokes in the beginning of this movie. And as it goes along, I think this movie has major third act problems, where it starts out being pulpy and fun and stylish, and by the end it's splatterier, and it kind of turns almost into like the Equalizer at the end. It's more grisly as it goes along, and I think for me that made it a little bit less fun.
Interesting.
I do like the way this movie depicts the, especially the hand-to-hand combat that you're seeing, like in the stairwell, depicts it as incredibly exhausting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think you do, in that way, get a sense. This movie is directed by someone with an extensive background in stunt work, and I think that is to this movie's benefit. And so, yeah, maybe I am a little bit more. I don't mean to say like I'm a little more sensitive. I'm a delicate flower when it comes to violence. It seemed less witty. It seemed less like a ballet as the movie goes along.
Okay. How about you, Chris? What did you think?
I don't know if everyone here is as devoted to the Gospel of John Wick as certainly Glenn and I are, but David Leitch, who made this movie, is one of the two directors with Chad Stahelski of John Wick. Certainly shares with it that sort of long take aesthetic, the exhaustion that you mentioned, Stephen, that comes through in the fight scenes. There is sort of a purity of storyline to John Wick in that it's just a revenge movie with sort of a goofy trigger.
Right.
Daisy, that dog is so cute. Like no one could blame him. But
This
movie is more of like an uneasy marriage of that sort of thing with kind of a John Le Carré, you know, the existential loneliness of the spy kind of thing. It's like it starts off as a Roger Moore Bond movie and sort of turns into Casino Royale where, you know, Bond is drinking to stop himself from shaking and trying to rinse the blood off his shirt. And I'm like a B plus on this movie. I agree about the third act problems. I think there are a few too many reversals at the end. There's a third act reveal where my response was more like, what? You know, rather than just like, oh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The stuff that I go to this genre for, the style, the music, the production design, and the charisma of the central figure are all fully satisfied. I to see Charlize Theron in an action movie that deserves her is great.
Yeah, this was one that really got me thinking because I am so often put off by hugely gory movies and television. And this I really, really enjoyed. And I sort of spent a lot of time thinking, okay, here's a movie exactly like Steven says, it shares with The Equalizer the quality that if it is on the screen and it is sharp, somebody's going to stick it in some part of somebody else at some point. And there is a lot of that. And some of it is kind of comedically over the top. Mm-hmm. I don't want to spoil any of it, but there are definitely some kind of almost darkly funny puncture wounds in this movie. I was really surprised by it, and I was thinking, what was it about this that made it so much easier for me to tolerate? And I think it is the fact that I found it so visually interesting. I found it so much fun to look at. And that is partly the clothes and the look and the, I mean, I think one of the best shots in the movie is spoiled in the trailer, which I think is too bad.
A lot one is of spoiled the, in the trailer.
Yeah, but I think one of the coolest looking things that they do in the movie is spoiled in the trailer. And it involves kind of her trying to conceal herself from, you know, in a crowd. And I think it's too bad that things like that are spoiled because there are a bunch of things like that that are really, I think, visually interesting. And it took me back a little bit to seeing Valerian because there was so much talk about Valerian being incredibly imaginative. And this actually struck me. There were more shots in this that made me sit there and think, that's such a cool shot. Mm-hmm. There's quite a bit of, there are several times when you find people underwater for various reasons. Mm-hmm. I think those shots are beautiful. I do think they got it right as far as the clothes, particularly on her, they look appropriate to the period, and yet they're incredibly stylized and modern in the way that they present on the screen. Mm-hmm. I feel like it's almost like super violent 80s television because so much of 80s kind of action shows were about spies who have to get something before it falls into the hands of the KGB. And it doesn't really matter what the thing is. It's just a lot of, you know, handoffs and, you know, it's what they did on MacGyver and it's what they did on Scarecrow and Mrs. King and all that stuff. Only this is made in a much more kind of meticulous fashion.
Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of criticism this film is getting, people saying there's nothing new here. And what's new here is the same thing with Wonder Woman. It's a woman doing all this stuff. In this case, it's a 40-year-old woman doing much of these stunts herself. And that adds something because she can't fight like dudes would, right? She's not built like an MMA fighter. So that adds a layer to these fight scenes where she has to use the environment. She uses garden hoses and corkscrews and freezer doors. And that makes it ingenious in a way. It's not a fight we've seen. Even when they're well choreographed, we've seen people punch each other a lot. What we haven't seen to this extent is this use of the environment. And also, she did a lot of her own stunts. And even if you are hurling yourself down fake stairs that are made of pudding, which I don't think these were, you're still hurling yourselves down stairs. And it's just... being able to see her go through all this in an era when everything is cheated with CGI is just, it's what I mean, it's visceral.
I think that use of the environment is what makes a great fight and what makes a great action scene. There's been an increased willingness, especially in the movie that these guys, Stiluski and Leach, do. I mean, only Leach worked on this movie. Stiluski made John Wick 2. To have these fights in confined spaces, in elevators, in cars. And part of that, is, as Leach has talked about, is budgetary. Mm-hmm. But it's also more interesting.
And it reminds me a little bit of the conversation we had, one of the conversations we had about Spider-Man Homecoming, which was... when you start to develop a genre by making everything bigger, 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 sometimes there is a certain effectiveness in all of a sudden coming back to where it's much more confined. Mm-hmm. And if you are a person who is driven mad by the way that they now edit fights so that you don't have a sense of where people are in space,
right,
because the cutting is so fast and the shots are so short... this is the opposite. That staircase fight that we have been talking about is shot. I think there are a couple of places where you can see that there's a kind of a hidden cut, mm-hmm, so that it's not actually all one take, but it is shot to look like all one take. And I think that is both to allow you to better experience where everything is in space so that you do better appreciate what they're doing, and also to show off, I think, a little bit the fact that she is doing a lot of her own stunts. I think the more you're not cutting, the more, yeah, you know, you see her face, and then you see her go down the stairs and it's her. And yes, some of that can be done with CGI, and I have no idea whether there's any of that going on. I've read the same thing as Glenn, that she did a lot of the stunts herself.
I printed out the production notes before I came in here, not realizing that they ran to 65 pages. So I probably
nice.
would not have done that. There is an Easter egg to movie nerds in this movie, where one of the fights takes place in a movie theater in Berlin that is showing the Tarkovsky film Stalker,
right,
which I think our friend Scott Tobias mentioned in his review. So, of course, when I'm seeing this, I'm like, well, what's the... I mean, I had read about Stalker. I hadn't seen it. It's just come out in the Criterion Collection. But I'm like, this has to mean something. This has to be like the way they stop in Logan to watch Shane for a couple minutes, and it's
right,
going to underscore that.
Right.
So here's what I've come up with. The average length of a shot in Stalker is over a minute.
Yeah.
This is a 2-hour, 45-minute movie. That, like, there are 4- and 5-minute shots in this film.
In Stalker.
But the editing pace Stalker is glacial.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, according to the 65 pages of production notes, it just happened that there really was a screening of Stalker in Berlin when they were shooting. But I don't know. I think maybe it's a joke about the, you know, them pushing back on the sort of Fast and Furious CGI heavy, you know, we'll fix it in post style of action movie making versus this... the John Wick, Atomic Blonde, Mission Impossible style that just runs more closely to my taste. You know, I like the style that puts it more on the performer, on the day, what you can do in front of the camera.
I do think that the visuals in this film felt more indebted to comic books than a lot of what we think of as comic book movies. This is a movie with comic book origins. Mm-hmm. It's based on The Coldest City by Anthony Johnson and Sam Hart. And you can almost see the panels around these images just off screen. The use of, I would say, gratuitous use of cigarette smoke in this movie to kind of
Tony Scott. Like the blue smoke all over the place.
To kind of frame people's faces, the use of color, the scene where she's emerging from the bathtub in this kind of blue-gray light. It feels comic booky in the best possible way, where it's the imagery is very stark and very clear, but also very, very artful. I do have one question, and it was one that I struggled with a little bit as I was processing this movie after walking out of the theater. I was like, gosh, I really like that. Did I like it just because I like Charlize Theron so much? And like, if you took out Charlize Theron and plopped in Gerard Butler, mm-hmm, how different would this movie be?
I think it'd be fundamentally different. I think that's the whole appeal, is that it's not just another spy movie. It's another spy movie with a very important twist.
Yeah, and I would argue it's not just, you know, it's different because she's a 40-year-old woman, as Glenn mentioned, but It's different because she's a really good actress.
Yeah.
And she, I think, really puts a character at the center of this movie. And the character is kind of a type, right? As we were talking about, she is kind of the spy who has seen everything and has begun to close off her emotions and all that. But it's still, I think, a very good performance. And one of the other things that struck me was very early in this movie, there is a sequence, I think maybe even the first time you see her, in which she is largely nude. But I felt like even though there's a fair amount of nudity in this movie, particularly of her, I think the scenes where she is naked are some of the least sexy shots of her in the movie, which I think is very interesting.
Yeah.
I think she is less eroticized in the shots where she has no clothes on, because very often she's naked because she's healing from injuries.
Right.
And that's really what they're showing you. And the shots where she's incredibly, where I feel like they've really cranked up kind of her sexuality, are the ones where she's the most coolly dressed and inventively and lovingly shot, and you're looking at her eyes and lips and things like that. I don't know if anybody else had the same sense, but I noticed that right away.
Well, I would agree with that. And while we're talking about the sexual element of this film, I do like the romance with Sophia Boutella, who is usually under, you know, 10 pounds of latex makeup like she was an alien in the last Star Trek movie. And you know, and I mean, I'm sure that's going to be like, oh, yeah, fanboy, you know, we need to have two women kissing in the trailer or whatever. But I mean, I sort of like it because that is a very Bond thing. The idea that there's going to be this, mm-hmm. this very immediate coupling, and whether there's any emotional grounding for it, you know, we don't know. It seems like in this movie, they're kind of, you know, there's the start of something like that. That's very much a convention of this genre, you know, the sort of quick romance that may be just of the moment, maybe not. But having, you know, letting Charlize be the initiator of that and not have it be a thing, mm-hmm. you know, not something that the movie
yeah.
needs to deal with. I just like the way it was matter of fact about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I didn't feel like the movie was sort of pointing arrows at that, saying, isn't this interesting or sexy because they're
yeah.
both women, which
I mean,
is such a common...
I think they wanted that shot in the trailer, but
right,
other than
and
that.
I do remember noticing that there was one trailer that played that up and one that didn't, and mm-hmm. I think it depended partly on who the audience was. But I didn't feel like inside the boundaries of the film that they were really doing that, that they were really saying, let's point to this and say, this is sexy because they're both women and isn't that naughty. I think, like Chris said, it's very much the Bond romance that you see in a lot of these films.
Exactly. And, you know, I'm pretty sensitive to when something is targeted at not me, when a scene like that is meant for 14-year-old fanboys. And that it didn't feel like that to me. It's also interesting in that it's flipped from the comic. In the comic, the French agent that she has a liaison with is male. So it's something that they added to the film for whatever reason.
Interesting. What did you guys think of the music?
Loved it. Why? What's wrong?
Cool.
What?
Awesome. Well, yeah, it's all this sort of what I would think of as like Euro-tinged 80s music.
Sure.
Which makes a lot of sense. So it's like
your 99 left belongs.
Uh-huh.
Right.
Sure.
But the
sure.
fact that this movie is set in 1989 and most of the songs are from like 83, 84,
yep.
85 is just perfect because, you know, especially behind the Iron Curtain, they're going to be a few years
okay.
behind.
Okay.
Like the use of voices carry when they actually turn that up to baffle a listening mm-hmm. device so they mm-hmm. can't be eavesdropping. I mean, it's on the nose.
That's just
but
that's a little
care,
on the
but
nose.
It's a
but it's clever.
But it's cool. I did order the 2LP Mondo vinyl soundtrack of this album, so I guess I liked
it. Oh, yeah. I might have to listen to that. That sounds like a lot of fun. I will be curious to hear what all of you think of Atomic Blonde. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet at us at PCHH. Later this week, we're going to be coming to you with a discussion of the HBO comedy Insecure. So thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you next time.